session number 18830, Reel 4.
It's a Yavozhin Reel 4. And you evidently found it easier to learn English.
Yes, I did. Yes, I found it. I found it easy to learn the English required to train as a pilot, the technical language. I recalled very easily and remembered easily. More difficulties, of course, would happen when trying to talk to people. That would take a long time, if ever, to get it right. English is very good in the first few months of learning it. It has these basic words which one can remember easily. After that come idioms and all kinds of other difficulties.
Any incidents that happened to you in the training?
In the initial training, I unfortunately made friends with unfortunately, I anticipate what I'm about to say with one of the... So I separated from my good friend, but I made immediately friends with one of the pilots who already... Polish pilots who already was well advanced in Poland. And perhaps partly because all this initial training was rather a bit of a bore to him, he very quickly began to perform aerobatics and do all kinds of rather crazy things, which a pupil with 10 hours of flying never saw. And he started, of course, teasing me how what a waste of time I, for example, spent climbing to 3,000 feet to do some aerobatics when you could do them at 500 feet. And he trained me to fly and then never get above 1,000 feet, to every aerobatic you could think of, without climbing, wasting time on climbing into the higher up, that type of things. So we became a rather wild pair doing things which obviously...
Was this Genyak?
No, this was... I don't even remember his name. No, Genyak disappears now in terms of being a friend of flying, because he's been left behind in Blackpool to go to ground as a ground crew where they needed people for use having failed. He fought to get yet another medical, so he had to be good so that they would let him take fourth or fifth medical.
What kind of planes did you wish to fly once you were trained?
Oh, I thought I'd be a fighter, of course. There was no other plane that I could think of. So we thought, I thought, good, he's teaching me the sort of things that fighter must know or be like, this wild aerobatics and so on. And this went through a lot, big part of the school, and I think the British RAF instructors, I always thought RAF instructors the best in the world. They really were fantastic. They were committed, and they were extremely good with the pupil, with us certainly. Excuse me. Patient, and in this case, perhaps too discreet, because they must have seen all the wild things that went on, and that certainly was strictly forbidden, because aerobatics came at a certain stage of the course where you were supposed to start and do things. Well, by then, we were not only formation flying, but we were upside-down formation flying, all kinds of things like that, which, of course, were never allowed for the primary students. And that was, in a way, our undoing, because we once took off in a formation, that is, the two of us, and the chief instructor who was taking people at the last test saw us. And saw this, and he was flying at the time, and flew near enough to identify the aircraft. And we were disciplined for it, and in fact, it was, I think, thanks to our being Poles or foreigners, perhaps wild, perhaps not fully understanding what they, what transgression they now are committing. We were allowed to leave, continue our training without passing the final test, which meant that we got both just average for this training. Of course, I was young and perhaps wild. I was very ungrateful. I thought, how dare they give me an average when I know I'm much better than those around me. I was not at all appreciative of the fact that we have been saved, because if had we been English, we would have been thrown out immediately, because it was an indiscipline of an order that we had done. And it took us some time to realize that discipline was a part of the pilot's training, and obeying orders was a part of it. And we finished the course and waited for the next assignment, which decided whether you were a fighter or bomber pilot, because either you went on a single engine aircraft or a twin engine for training. And one day order came, and all the Poles except for one were all sent to for the bomber pilots, because Poles followed a different line in many ways, not entirely, but I read this also in English books that happened to others. It was the demand that decided, demand for a certain type of people that decided where mostly people went, not what they wanted, or even if they showed ability, unless they had absolutely some phenomenal, exceptional ability. If at that time they needed bomber pilots, you were a bomber pilot. And that's what happened to us, happened to me. I went on Oxford's from there, from Miles Magister to Oxford aircraft, to Cirencester or South Cerny, I think Cirencester, area of Cirencester. I'm not sure whether it's South Cerny or Cirencester, which is the RAF station. Anyway, that's where I followed, with the same also close friend of this rather wild Polish pilot. And flying Oxford was much more difficult, much more required, much more attention. But that's where I started doing well. I soloed probably the first in the whole group. We are now combined Poles and British students were together. I must have been one of the first to solo, and it all went very well. And I became separated from that friend because he was even wilder than before. He did all kinds of aerobatics, started doing aerobatics on Oxford, which I could no longer follow. It was beyond my ability. I felt, anyway, I was beginning to get worried about the consequences of being seen doing these things. There were losses. We've lost people killed. Training has, even on Oxford, has cost the RAF quite a lot of people killed. And we had also some navigational flights flying into hills, but also others trying things which they shouldn't have, flying under the famous bridge, for example, Bristol.
Clifton Suspension.
That's
Bridge.
It, Clifton Suspension Bridge. I lost two friends there. We were I could recall for a long time, we all sat one evening and they said they must go on under this bridge. So I had a look at the bridge by myself on a solo and could see that this was no joke. This was hard flying and uncertainty, because there were difficult places and currents, air currents, which you couldn't anticipate the way that bridge sat. But they went and hit a tree soon and were killed. Flying at night, night flying came, and I was soloed after 1 hour of, I think I was again the first to solo on at night. Yes, almost certainly. Night flying came to me almost naturally. I just did it right from the beginning. And I helped somebody. I recall when the what it was that Polish students had a different line to follow from the British student, in that, for example, we could not anticipate at the end of the course, and the commissions were not given to Polish students. You just trained, became a sergeant, and you had to be glad that you did that. Whereas there were other possibilities, so perhaps the behavior were slightly different. We had nothing to gain by certain things. We had nothing to show more than we were doing, because nobody would reward us in any special way for it. I think there were slight differences in that line. Anyway, I finished up in on the top five people who had above average in flying. And that was it. I got my wings then in Oxford. Then followed a sort of routine that the Polish pilots followed, to Blackpool to wait for next posting. I was among those who were not sent directly to the squadron, but were sent to be a staff pilot. On Bothas were the name of the aircraft at RAF Morpeth.
What's a staff pilot?
Staff pilot was...
You were just about to tell me what a staff pilot is, please.
Staff pilot was a pilot assigned to a school, for example, air gunnery school. He was the pilot who stayed there and flew the aircraft and acted as instructor at times to the air gunnery pupils. So he would stay at that station for 6 to 9 months, flying the same aircraft and taking pupils up for their training exercises.
So when
on the staff.
So when did you get into operations?
From there, I was sent by mistake to mosquito bullfighter training station, OTU, and then I had to go to be trained as a navigator. So I didn't go directly to the operations from there. I went back to Blackpool, by this time to Blackpool Airport, RAF Blackpool, to fly to train as a second class navigator, a requirement of pilots flying with the, this was a GR school, General Reconnaissance School, in Squires Gate is the name of this, of the RAF station in Blackpool. I was sent there and obtained the navigator's certificate from it. By then, it was required that pilots who were the captains of aircraft, with the duties that the Coastal Command demanded of the cruise, it was expected that the pilot would be able to also navigate. So from, and then, only then, from that school, I was assigned to the squadron, that is 304 Polish Coastal Command Squadron. And in, say, May 1943.
Where were they based?
They were based at North.
This is in England?
Oh, Cornwall or North Devon, very, very close.
St. Morgan?
Not that deep into the...
It appears from your logbook that it's David Stowe Moore.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of operations were they doing at the time?
They were doing daytime operations on anti-submarine daytime operations on Wellingtons. They're just finishing off using their Bomber Command 1C, Wellington 1C, Mark 1C, and were training to transfer onto Wellington 10, Mark 10, in White Wellington at the time. Also, they were training to become a torpedo squadron. So crews would go out to train on torpedo attacks.
So were you a pilot or a navigator?
No, I was a pilot. I was always meant to be a pilot, but pilots were required to have this navigator certificate. By 1943, the expectation of pilots have increased, and the expectation of coastal command operations were such that this was expected. So we did. I started as a second pilot, of course. The coastal command required two pilots to fly. The flights were of 10-hour plus duration, daytime. From there, the cover was in Bay of Biscay, was the main area, which was a very active area of, and very active in terms of U-boats going through there and back from the French bases, and active by German fighters to protect the U-boats while going through this from RAF aircraft. So there was a lot of activity over Bay of Biscay. I did read somewhere, and it went on, how boring a coastal command flying was. That was said by some air gunner flying somewhere. He found it boring. Well, anybody who flew over Bay of Biscay and then later at night at 500 foot level attacking at 25 foot level with a searchlight could not find flying very boring at any point in time. But that's anticipating in a way, because what happened was we started on these aircraft, and I think there were discussions. Coastal Command was being expanded. The losses still continued of shipping. It was catastrophic, as you probably know from other people, over the period of particularly first 2 years. At times it looked almost disastrous. That something had to be done to stop the incredibly high losses. And so the Coastal Command was expanded in various ways. Squadrons were pulled in from Bomber Command, like 304, and squadrons were employed on new techniques that the Coastal Command tried to bring in. One of the major problems that it started to turn out was night attacks. Until 1942, the U-boats, if attacked continuously during the day, even if you saturated the air over the Bay of Biscay during the day. They would sit underwater and come up during the night. Now, they could by then be detected mostly by the radar. Mark I was still a radar. It wasn't fantastic, but it could detect, find a U-boat. So that at night you could tell there was a U-boat, but that was a long way from there to attack it. How are you going to get close enough and know where to drop your bombs? This was one of the urgent requirements of the Coastal Command to find a way to cope with it. And I've done quite a lot of study, in fact, of this, how the development of the night operations anti-submarine. The one that we became involved in was Leelight operations. Now, this was developed by Squadron Leader Lee, who was on the headquarters of Coastal Command, a first war pilot, who found that if you combined radar with some visible way of seeing the U-boat, you could develop a technique which would be much more successful, and certainly would be successful in doing something to the U-boats. And by 1942, first, I think Squadron 172 was the first one to get a few of the Wellingtons converted into this kind of operation. Radar, more modern radar, and searchlight, which was located in a turret. The old Wimpy had that turret, which could be pulled out. And the searchlight, he put everything very simple. The searchlight was just the same type that anti-aircraft units used, and it was installed. I think there are examples that the actual Leelight is located at some of the museums around London. And it turned out, a very extensive training. The crew had to coordinate itself to be able, once the U-boat was detected, you now had to, in the distance between the U-boat and yourself, you had to descend to the right height that the searchlight would effectively operate, and that the height was not too high for the depth charges to be dropped. They cannot be dropped, could not be dropped from any height. So the searchlight had to be lowered. Somebody had to stand in front to operate then the searchlight. So one of the crew had to stand. The radar operator had to lead the pilot in the right way, and so on. So the signals had to be sent out. There are often interference by enemy fighters, night fighters. All this had to be taken care of. That took quite a lot of training. And in June 1942, the first attack was actually carried out by 172 Squadron, successful attack on an Italian U-boat. Well, the Poles came to these, and these were flown by Wellington. Wellington also had to be modified. Better engine, more powerful engine was required to carry so much extra weight and to still have sufficient range. And these were Mark 12 and 14. But the Poles went pretty well directly onto Wellington 14, which was really the last Wellington Mark modification. So after this first daylight operations, which was in many ways very exciting for Poles who come from a country which has hardly any sea to more than about 50 miles, to be flying non-stop over the sea was an entirely new experience. I certainly am for myself, coming from the mountain region, this was something new. But the training was extremely useful that we have gone through this general reconnaissance, the navigator's training, because we are already oriented towards ships. We were required to recognize, identify every British naval ship, identify all the U-boats, everything in that line. We had learned how to do it at that school, navigational school. So that was of great help. And we started transferring onto these Wellingtons 14, and the training started. It would take quite a long time because also the bombing techniques had to be learned and other things. When I was then put to the first pilot, to OTU, Operation Training Unit, to become first pilot captain of the crew. This station, at the time, the station, Polish OTU, coastal OTU work was from RAF Siloth. That's back again near Carlisle and that area.
Did you have any encounters with the U-boats?
Yes, but they submerged. The ones that we encounter, we haven't actually encountered. We've met more German fighters than U-boats. We were met by, and they represented a distraction, a menace. There are lots of stories. In fact, when I put the summary together after some years, these encounters with the fighters predominated in a way the daytime flying. By 1943, the Germans were well organized in their fighter patrolling of the base, and there were lots of attacks by them on the anti-submarine patrolling, big twin and four engine. There were Liberators and Halifaxes were flying, Sunderlands. Everybody was there, Wimpies and what do you call the older type still.
Don't worry. But can you describe any incidents that happened to you in which you came into contact with the enemy in the form of fighters or even U-boats?
Later, by myself, they all get rather mixed up. Because the encounters with fighters were a sudden, you know. Later on, you had a radar which helped you to actually find them. This later radar was able to see up to and above your height. Yes, we met enemy fighters, and we met U-boats, which we made attack on, and but we haven't sunk anything. I think there were a variety of factors which I think, you know, everybody tried to attack, but not many were successful. Some were fantastically successful in other squadrons. I think these areas, RAF was fantastic, you know, was extremely efficient. And the older, in the sense, regular pilots who have flown. This is something which I have not mentioned before, but it comes out, and it comes out later, how, no matter what people said, how different the training was, no pilot is trained if he doesn't fly to any standard of operational flying, whether then or now, whether he doesn't do his 2 years flying. And it's no use people bluffing. Those who flew well right from the beginning of the war and throughout the war and made careers and so on,